Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about why microgreens should be a part of your daily superfood diet, how anger causes inflammatory conditions, how onions can control obesity, diabetes, and blood pressure, how olive leaf combats heart trouble, how older adults consume more phytonutrients, and could a hug a day be as good as an apple a day at keeping the doctor away? Carnegie Mellon University says yes, and a lot more. Also, from our environmental segment today, look at oceanographers in the United States warn that volumes of methane equivalent to a major oil spill are rising to the surface each year as warmer waters heat the frozen ocean bed. What does it mean? For those of you who've watched people running around the country claiming that it is irresponsible, bad parenting not to vaccinate your children or yourself, claiming that there's no evidence whatsoever between autism and vaccines, we're here to respond with actual science, not propaganda. The average college freshman reads at what grade level? That's our question. I'd like you to call in and tell me what average college freshman reads at what grade level. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Ice cold and cut services create dangerous perfect storm for homeless. We'll deal with that. The Harvard professors are in an uproar after learning Obamacare applies to them. Oh, you mean the same professors that were all for Obamacare? Yeah, now not so much. Also, later in our program today, we're going to hear from Arthur C. Clarke describing the Internet in 1974. Whoa. And listen to how accurate he was. We'll also be having a challenge to the value of a police life versus a civilian life. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. First up, microgreens, I believe, are the future, especially for people who want to do something that is very conscientious, very green, very important, very organic. Microgreens. You start small. You start in your kitchen, your backyard. You start on a rooftop, depending upon the weather conditions where you live. But it's easy to master. Within 3 or 4 months, you'll be growing more microgreens you can possibly consume. Then you start to realize that these are wonderful, highly nutritious little leaves. They come in dozens of varieties, like kale and cabbages and onions and garlics. These are the microgreens. These are the little greens, maybe an inch, half inch, quarter inch. They grow quickly, generally under 30 days. And there's a big market for them. So I suggest that for home-based business people. But now when you take a look at the microgreen, that's merely a little older version of a sprout. It is extremely rich. It grows, the whole plant grows generally between 1 and 3 inches, and it doesn't take long. Some microgreens, from germination of the seed to ready to harvest, is 2 weeks. Some it's 3 weeks. They're mellow, they're spicy, they're tangy, all different types of flavors. Radishes, fennel, mustard, collards, beets, bok choy. And here's what really makes them interesting. They contain upwards of 4,000% more nutrients than your regular full-grown lettuce. So the more microgreens you can eat, the better it is. Red cabbage, for example, is a microgreen. has 600% more vitamin C than a regular mature head of cabbage. You get 4,000% more vitamin E than you would in a regular plant. And green daikon, also very high concentrations of vitamin K, vitamin E, vitamin C compared to the regular plant. And the regular plants, anywhere from 60 to 100 days for them to grow. And here you got 2 weeks to 3 weeks. So start reading up on microgreens. Now I'm doing some microgreens. I'll film them and show you how it's done, how easy, how inexpensive, and how much fun it is. One of the nutrients I suggest people take every day is turmeric. Or if you don't want to take turmeric, just go directly and take curcumin, which is the active ingredient. New research shows that turmeric may boost vegetarians' brains' omega-3, the DHA levels. That's from the National Institutes of Health. And we know that turmeric is one of nature's most powerful herbs. It's extremely beneficial in its phytochemical compound, helping with cognitive disorders, memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. In fact, the National Institutes of Health funded a study entitled Curcumin Boosts DHA in the Brain, Implications for the Prevention of Anxiety Disorders. Researchers found that curcumin, I generally recommend it between, let's say, 800 and 4,000 milligrams, enhances the biosynthesis of the essential fatty acids, DHA. And that's important. There are more than 7,000 published papers over the past 45 years and on curcumin in the peer-reviewed literature. So it's simply an essential. And everyone who has Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, or memory loss, or cancer should be taking it every day. Anger, if channeled correctly, can be an important way of expressing something that you're frustrated or concerned about. When I see injustice, I do something about it. The injustice creates anger, a normal emotion, and then I create a documentary like Seeds of Death, The Silent Epidemic, Knocking on the Devil's Door, Death by Medicine, Poverty Inc., and dozens more, or write a book or article, do a broadcast. But it's when you don't express your anger in a constructive way that it turns against you. Really bad. This is from the University of Pittsburgh, published in the peer-reviewed journal Brain, Behavior, and Immunity. Quote, those who become angry or anxious easily are more prone to inflammatory disease like cardiovascular ailments than others. Quote, this could help explain why some people with high levels of stress experience chronic health problems. So, if you are a person that doesn't want your blood pressure raised or your heart rate to increase, then find better ways of dealing with stress. Inflammation is a process by which the body's white blood cells protect us from infection and foreign substances like bacteria and viruses. Quote, individuals who become angry or anxious when confronted with relatively minor challenges in their lives are prone to increase inflammation. That is not healthy. Yoga, meditation, biofeedback, all ways of dealing with anger. I believe that an onion, a sweet onion, a half an onion, you don't have to eat a whole one, but a half an onion a day keeps a stroke away because it thins the blood. It doesn't allow the clumping of the aggregation of the blood platelets. And that's good. It also is filled with sulfur, and sulfur is one of nature's most perfect healing compounds, especially for joint problems, for viruses, for bacteria, for immune problems, for parasites in the intestine and blood. So an onion, garlic, shallots, chives, extremely healing. This is the latest from the University of Southern Queensland, published in the Journal of Nutrition. Quote, a new study shows that onions can be instrumental in regulating weight, besides preventing diabetes, and reducing blood pressure. So, one more reason to make sure that you get your onions each day. In Italy, in Spain, and in France, in Crete, you will find olive trees, lots of them. Though Italy is going through a real problem now because of severe drought, thousands upon thousands of trees are dying. They also have when they don't get enough water and they're not fertilized, they're susceptible to various fungus, which can also kill them. And you hate to see that because some of these trees are 1,000 years old. Here's the latest. Quote, researchers have said that a pill made out of the leaves of olive trees can be useful in combating heart disease. In the study, patients who took the olive leaf pill for 8 weeks saw a significant decline in blood pressure and triglycerides, harmful blood fats that accelerate and accentuate the risk of heart attacks and strokes. And by the way, high blood pressure is thought to be responsible for 50% of all heart attacks and strokes. And that's where garlic and onion, vitamin C, bring down your chance of a heart attack or a stroke. And also olives, just eating olives, have been credited with helping to lower the risk of breast cancer, ulcerative colitis, even depression. These plants have chemicals that have been shown to help slash the risk of these diseases. So, inexpensive, tasty, yes. In fact, if you took some olives, black, green, red, brown, and you took off the flesh, and then you added in some garlic, onion, mustard, olive oil, and Himalayan sea salt and pepper, and you mash that, and then put that inside of rice when it's done and it's steeping, and you stir it around. Makes a delicious rice dish. I just made that last night, in fact. Older adults consume more phytonutrients. This is an interesting study presented at the Congress of Experimental Biology. They found that older adults are consuming higher levels of carotenoids, flavonoids, and other phytonutrients. Why? Because they're eating more fruits and vegetables. Because we have a whole generation of baby boomers who are better educated, worldly, and understanding that they have to be very conscientious about what they put in their bodies. Remember, your flavonoids are rich in quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, and antho, A-N-T-H-O, psi, C-Y, anidins, A-N-I-D-I-N-S, anthocyanidins, and that supports healthier brain. There's also in pomegranates, strawberries, and walnuts what is called ellagic acid, and this ellagic acid helps ward off cancers, including breast and prostate cancer. So the older you get, if you're an educated person, the more fruits and vegetables and juices you're going to get. In fact, what we have found, and I was curious about this. I've noticed that there's a whole lot of juice bars opening up, which I'm happy about, on the Upper West Side. Used to be that there was none. And in the last year, there have been three that open up on the Upper West Side. In fact, now there's four vegetarian or vegan restaurants within 100 feet of each other. They're on opposite corners and then in the block below. Actually, it's three, not four. And they all serve good and healthy and, you know, tasty food. And almost all their customers are young. And I've eaten in these places, young people. And then the juice bars, I wanted to see, is this also true? Here's what's interesting. I'm finding, based upon counting people, how many juices are served, and what is the approximate age of the people, that more than 80% of the juices being served are people over the age of 50, which means that older people, when questioned, professional people, people like lawyers, engineers, doctors, professors, are consuming more juices. And on the Upper West Side, near Columbia University, lots of professors. Not the students, the professors, drinking more juices. So they're getting their all of their, or a lot of their phytonutrients. I'm glad to see that. And finally, instead of an apple, could a hug a day keep the doctor away? According to new research from Carnegie Mellon University, that may be a legitimate process. And Professor Daughtry, University Professor of Psychology at Carnegie Mellon University, tested whether hugs act as a form of social support, protecting stressed people from getting sick. The results were published in Psychosociological Sciences. They found the greater social support and more frequent hugs protected people from the increased susceptibility to infection associated with being stressed and resulted in less severe illness symptoms. So, hugs really do make a difference. And therefore, we should be receiving and giving more hugs. On the environmental segment, as you know, we are not doing anything as a nation. Individuals are, some companies are. Some young startups are doing good with new innovative green technologies. I've sent off my ideas for how we could clean up the debris in the oceans, and I'll just share the idea. I'll share the overall idea with you because I am an inventor. I've invented over 300 inventions. And this is just the latest. But this I don't have time to do myself with all the projects I have. So I just put it out there. So if anyone wants to take it and run with it, good. It helps the common good, and that's the whole purpose of the exercise. Visualize a whaling ship. But instead of having whales caught and then you bring them into the ship when you lower the front part of the ship and then they're processed, imagine you had ships that were very wide, structurally sound, that when they are able, through sonar reading, see large pools of plastic, they're able to bring these in, and then you take them to a high temperature, but you have filtration units, and then you create a liquid that then can be put into solid blocks. As a result, you're able to recycle the plastic, something useful, or bury it in a place in lined pits, but you also are getting it out of the ocean. Huge amounts. Now, there's over a trillion items out there, so this would require a lot of these ships, but it would work. I've looked at the mechanics, I've looked at the chemistry of it. In effect, you process it at sea. Just one way of dealing with it. And then you could also have other ships that are support ships, like cargo ships, that take these large blocks, solid blocks of plastic, and then take them back to port. So the ships don't have to return. They can just continue to stay out there. And, in effect, vacuum up. In the Pacific, the worst areas of that vortex of plastic. You know, this is a separate issue. It comes from Climate News, and it's talking about the methane. We've discussed this many times on the show. Methane is trapped in frozen layers below the Pacific Ocean seafloor. But now more and more of the greenhouse gases are bubbling up to the surface as the deep water begins to warm. Quote, we calculate that methane equivalent in volume to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010 is released every year off the Washington coast, according to a professor at the University of Washington School of Oceanography. Now, methane hydrates are the natural gas methane in solid form. Volume for volume, methane is at least 2,000% more potent at greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, although it's released in a smaller quantities and has a much shorter lifespan in the atmosphere. So vast quantities of the stuff are known to be trapped in sedimentary rock and seabed in the frozen form. So it's been there for thousands upon tens of thousands of years, frozen. Now it's warming. So until now, most of the focus has been on the methane hydrates in the Arctic, the fastest warming region on the planet. But it's not just there. We're finding millions of tons of methane have been released from the seafloor off just the coast of Washington State. So, not good. So pay attention, because that's one of the things that's warming the planet. There's been a lot of controversy surrounding the idea, do vaccines cause autism? Well, there's never been a legitimate debate on it. In fact, to the contrary, what you have is you have all the media siding with the manufacturers of vaccines, all the think tanks sending forth their paid-for experts to say that there is no association and it's irresponsible to even discuss it. And on the other side are the scientists that have actually looked at the literature and found, yes, there are associations. I want to put this in clear perspective, because right now there is a whole movement in the United States and around the world to have a relatively small group of people, no more than five or six, who are appearing on the media regularly saying there is no association, no association. They're not telling the truth. Let me explain this. And all this will be in a new article fully documented within the next 2 weeks. On the one hand, you have the National Institutes of Health. That's the overall umbrella. Under the National Institute of Health, you have the National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which promotes vaccines, National Institute on Aging, National Institute on Mental Health, and the Food and Drug Administration, and the CDC. Those are the main institutions under the National Institutes of Health. And to a person, they say there is no association. On the other side is the vaccine court. Now, the vaccine court is a really tricky court. First, there's no appeal. Secondly, it takes a long time for them to review each case. And what they do is the judges in the vaccine court bring in medical experts, scientists, to review the information of the patient's records and make scientific determinations. It is not political. It is not economic. It is purely science. And they have awarded 83 people substantial damages for totaling over $100 million because of autism-related conditions done by vaccines. Now, it's based upon good science. Scientists are doing this. Scientists recommend to the court what should be done. So that's not political science. That's legitimate science. So on the one hand, one agency of government says, yes, vaccines have been causing autism spectrum disorder conditions, and we have scientifically determined this by independent scientists. On the other side are nothing but political hacks, people who go from the FDA or CDC or one of the agencies into the vaccine-making field, like Gerberding, the former head of the CDC, went over to head the vaccine division of Merck, and now is one of the top people at Merck. So do I find anything that they say objective? No, it's all subjective. This is just the latest in this. This is a recent Italian court decision on vaccines from Age of Autism, Mary Holland. Quote, on September 23, 2014, an Italian court in Milan awarded compensation to a boy for vaccine-induced autism. A childhood vaccine against six childhood diseases caused the boy's permanent autism and brain damage. While the Italian press has devoted considerable attention to this decision and its public health implications, the U.S. press has been silent. Like the U.S., Italy has a national vaccine injury compensation program to give some financial support to those people who are injured by compulsory and recommended vaccinations. The Italian infant plaintiff received three doses of GlaxoSmithKline's Infarex Hexa, a hexavalent vaccine administered in the first year of life. These doses occurred from March to October 2006. The vaccine is to protect children from polio, diphtheria, tetanus, hepatitis B, pertussis, and influenza B. In addition to these antigens, however, the vaccine then contained thimerosal, the mercury, containing preservative aluminum, an adjuvant, as well as other toxic ingredients. The child regressed into autism shortly after receiving the three doses. When the parents presented their claim for compensation first to the Ministry of Health, as they were required to do, the ministry rejected it. Therefore, the family sued the ministry in a court of general jurisdiction, an option which does not exist in the same form in the United States. Based on expert medical testimony, the court concluded the child was suffering autism and brain damage due to the neurotoxic mercury, aluminum, and his particular susceptibility from a genetic mutation. The court also noted that Inforex Hexa contained thimerosal, now banned in Italy because of its neurotoxicity, quote, in concentrations greatly exceeding the maximum recommended levels for infants weighing only a few kilograms, end quote. This was a 1,271-page confidential GlaxoSmithKline report, which is now available on the Internet, which was a damning piece of evidence. The industry document provided ample evidence of adverse events from vaccines, including 5 known cases of autism resulting from the vaccine administrations during its clinical trials. All this was hidden. Now, right now, I'm looking at the manufacturer of the vaccine's own documents showing adverse effects, including brain edema, intracranial pressure, autism, another one, autism. So, when the truth came out, it was there. The Italian court ruled in the right way. Right now, there are hundreds of thousands of kids in the United States diagnosed with autism. It is my belief that along with other environmental factors, it is principally the vaccines. There is no scientific justification for giving 80% of all the vaccines in the United States. None. Like, why would you give hepatitis B vaccine to an infant when you can clearly test titers and see that the child has no hepatitis? The child is born. Remember, we're all born with virtually minimal immune response. We get our immune system from our mother and from our exposure to the environment. So this is devastating to our system. Sooner or later, I believe someone's going to wake up and do the right thing and tell the truth about vaccination. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Ask you now, the average college freshman reads at what grade level? If you think you know, I'm going to go to the phones in a second, 888-874-4888. Also, just want to remind you that I'm mastering what is called the mastery stage of my new recipes. I've created them, and now my daughter Shelley, every Wednesday through Sunday in the afternoon, is preparing them and then tweaking them. And if people want to see how this is done and want to contribute, and you get to take home what you cook, and all these are going to be published within the next 4 months. But this is part of the process of making sure they work. You can call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and then you can go in and work with Shelley and learn a lot of techniques also. It's not a cooking class. It's about preparing dishes, because the next stage is, starting this week, we start photographing, styling them, and these are all going to be gourmet. Gourmet vegan. Lots of raw gourmet vegan dishes, too. Let's say hello to Tricia from Washington, D.C. Hi, Tricia.
Oh, hi, Gary. Thank you for your show.
Tricia, your turn.
I thought fourth grade, because that's the last class
that's
I remember reading.
All right. Then we'll see, do we have anyone else here? Let's say hello to Dawn. Hi, Dawn, your turn.
Hi, Gary.
Dawn, you're on the air from Maryland.
Yes, hello, Gary. Yes, it's from seventh grade.
Oh, they must not have held on. Well, if someone wants to call in and make a guess, I'd be happy to. We'll come back later in the show. Now we're going to play two segments. The first segment is from the great Arthur C. Clarke. Back in 1974, and this is on the coming of the internet, before we had an internet, before we had cell phones, before we had any of this stuff. Listen to how prophetic he was.
Well, with that movie, 2001, you're projecting us into the 21st century. I brought along my son, Jonathan, who in the year 2001 will be the same age as I am now. Maybe he will be better adjusted to this kind of world that you're trying to portray.
The big difference when he grows up, in fact, if we wanted to wait for the year 2001, is that he will have in his own house, not a computer as big as this, but at least a console through which he can talk to his friendly local computer and get all the information he needs for his everyday life, like his bank statements, his theater reservations, all the information you need in the course of living in a complex modern society. This will be in a compact form in his own house. He'll have a television screen like these here and a keyboard, and he'll talk to the computer, get information from it, and he'll take it as much for granted as we take the telephone.
I wonder, though, what sort of a life would it be like in social terms? I mean, if our whole life is built around the computer, do we become a computer-dependent society and a computer-independent individuals?
In some ways, but they'll also enrich our society because it'll make it possible for us to live really anywhere we like. Any businessman, any executive could live almost anywhere on Earth and still do his business through a device like this. And this is a wonderful thing. It means we want him to be stuck in cities, we better live out in the country or wherever we please, and still carry on complete interaction with human beings as well as with other computers.
Just imagine, he had it right. He was ahead of the curve, tremendously ahead of the curve. Now look at, if you're going to look forward, what could you possibly imagine would be coming in the near future? Wow. We're going to go we're going to listen to a person, E.O. Wilson, on how close we are to having major species go completely extinct. And why do I want this known? Because of how we can become so focused upon our own lives each day that we don't stop and look around, see the world that we're living in and what our lifestyles are doing to impact it. Let's listen now to him.
In my 5 years old, I've been through a lot of different worlds, mostly biological worlds and parts of the natural world and the like. And what I'm coming increasingly to concentrate on in whatever time I have left is the natural world and the necessary means that we have to use to save it. There are about 2 million species of plants, animals, and microorganisms that we know about that scientists have found, diagnosed, given a description of, and a scientific name. 2 million, almost exactly at the present time. The actual number of species in the world is estimated at roughly 8 million species, maybe 8 to 10. We don't know. Most of the natural world, most of nature, much of the living part of the environment is unknown to us. And of those species that we know, the 2 million, we only know the lives, of life cycles, and in the biology of only a tiny fraction. And of that tiny fraction that we know something about, we know an even, just a tiny fraction, again, of how they interact with other species. We are living in and dependent upon a world of a biosphere to which in which we evolved and then to which we are exquisitely well adapted in every part of our body and our mind. Razor thin, that biosphere within which our, we and our fellow organisms live without going into submersibles or spacesuits. And we are destroying a large part of it. The rate at which species are going extinct, this is the consensus order of magnitude. I've estimated, others have estimated different ways and so on, working in this field of extinction. The rate at which species are going extinct is on order of magnitude 1,000 times faster than what species were, how fast they were going before the coming of humanity. We're hemorrhaging the world's biodiversity. People know that, but they just don't seem to grasp what this means. What this means is that the living shield, just that from their point of view, the human point of view, the shield of living organism that maintains the environment is close to or exactly what humans need because we evolved as one of them is being shorn away. We estimate that the number of species of existing unimpaired at the end of the century would be just somewhere around one half. One half will be gone or on the brink of extinction at this rate of extinction. There are ways to stop this. And I think we're going to have to start talking about big changes in how much of the Earth's surface we put aside for nature just to keep it from going extinct in a very short period of time. And I'm in a group of scientists working very hard on that part right now. This is what I'm focused on, and I hope we might even see what some of the solutions will be. But here's one last interesting point. Just as our salvation is aided by an unintended consequence of women who get any economic freedom stop having children. That is, they drop having the children number below zero population growth, which is a very good thing for an overpopulated world right now. In other words, we don't have to enforce or persuade much more people to have fewer children. What we need to do is to move as much of the world population into the middle class with women's freedom. We could reach, well, the United Nations projection, reached 8 to 10 billion by the end of the century, and then the population begins to subside. What about consumption? Many people would say, oh, well, you know, 8, 10 billion people, that's still
incredibly delicate.
We're going to eat up the rest of the world.
That was legendary biologist Edward O. Wilson claiming that the biosphere is incredibly delicate, and without a change in behavior, he says, we will irreversibly harm the Earth's biodiversity. I would share, I appreciate his input, and I would support it, but I would go much further than that. I believe that it's a catch-22, and here's the catch-22. When India and China and Brazil and other emerging markets began to have major sales of their resources and their assets, the first thing that happened was the standard of living increased, but everyone wanted America's standard of living, not realizing how wasteful we are. We're only 4% of the world's population. We consume over 26% of the world's resources and pollute it as well. We're greater polluter than China, and they have 1.3 billion people. So if the idea is that we increase standard of living, yes. But shouldn't we have an evolved leadership that that explains that the responsibility we have towards each other and our sustainability is to go more minimalist instead of splurging, having more cars that pollute and the resources it takes for them, and more animal proteins to be consumed, all the land that has to be used for growing the soybean that is fed to the cattle. We have this endless loop. We need 2.5 planet Earths at the current rate to feed the people we have, based upon the wrong ideology that more is better. More is not better. The future must be minimalist. It must be getting people to understand veganism and respect for the soil and life, and also our own health in the process. That's what I would add to that. I want to share something that I think is so important, because I just, of course, finished premiering Poverty Inc. in Los Angeles and New York. And I had a chance to speak with thousands upon thousands of people who were homeless. This is something from Common Dreams that we should listen to. Quote, icy cold and cut services create dangerous perfect storm for homeless. As record-breaking cold weather sweeps across the nation this week, reports from around the nation show how the U.S. homeless population, which has risen dramatically in recent years, are being hit the hardest in the wake of slash funding that has left shelters overburdened and public services at their breaking point. From Springfield, Massachusetts, quote, Keith Keller, who is homeless, told 22 News, quote, on a night similar to the one we had last night, very cold, two individuals decided to make a statement. They slept on the steps of City Hall, and they froze to death. It's a death sentence. You can't survive. You get hypothermia, and you go to sleep and you die. Friends of the homeless volunteers were searching throughout the night for those in need, helping them find a warm place to sleep. From Greensboro, North Carolina, quote, while many people can crank up the heat during winter months, the homeless population don't have that option. Hundreds are stuck outside, sleeping in makeshift tents with no source of heat. With overnight low temperatures dropping into the teens, winter emergency shelters are overflowing. On most nights, hundreds of men, women, and children are staying at places like Greensboro Urban Ministry. We're caught between a rock and a hard place because of the weather. We don't want to be in this situation. Across the Jersey Shore, frigid temperatures and nasty winds sent the homeless into shelters and public spaces looking for a warm place to stay. People normally would spend the night in their cars or in public spaces outdoors. From Washington, D.C., Wednesday was the second night this year that the city had announced a cold emergency, which allows officials to order homeless people into shelters when the temperature hits 15 degrees or below without snow and 20 degrees when it's snowing. The trouble is the shelters are overpacked. There's no room. From Boston, at the Pine Street Inn, where demand for beds has reached record levels, more than 100 people have been sleeping on the floor of the lobby because there's no place else to sleep. Chicago, children including babies are part of a wave of homeless Chicagoans who have swelled the population of the city's largest 24-hour shelter past capacity. 1,075 people, including 30 children, slept on the floor, no place to sleep. We have 990 beds, but we don't turn anyone away, but people can sit on a chair. Buffalo. Homeless man in Buffalo loses legs to cold weather. And so it goes. So here's my question. How many homeless people are in the United States? That's something that no one's ever gotten right. But it's not difficult to do. Let me explain. Let's just say, for our argument's sake, to make it easy, it's not that far off, by the way, that we've had 7 million homes foreclosed on. And that on average, some have more, some have less, but we're using an average, you have 4 people per home. That's 7 times 4, which is 28 million. Now, that's 28 million. You also have people who were homeless before the crisis, like veterans. You have 900,000 homeless vets. You also have people who before this were living in vans and some tent cities. By the way, the tent city in New Jersey, which we filmed several times, in the middle of the winter, the local community authorized the fire department, police department to come in there and tear down their tents. They had no place to go. They had no heat. And then they make sure that the persons wouldn't burn firewood in their fireplaces in the tents. They tore down with bulldozers, which we filmed, it's in Poverty Inc., and put it in a dumpster. Well, that really shows humanity. So let's see these big, tough firefighters, you know, these really courageous cops. You go out there and you see a person that is homeless, helpless, penniless, middle of the winter, sitting beside a stove, and you take that away from them. How's that work out for you on a spiritual level? What goes through your mind? I realize you live in New Jersey, but at some point we got to stop using that as an excuse for its corruption, its inefficiency, its stupidity, and how it deals with crisis. We already have that in New York, the most corrupt state in the history of this planet. My God, it's filthy corrupt, from City Hall right up to Albany, and we all know that. All of us New Yorkers know how bad it is. You can buy and sell, politicians and have, and power gets you preferential treatment. Landlords are the ultimate power group in New York City, and if you doubt me, ask any one of the 165,000 small businesses that have closed. They weren't significant. Helping the landlords with their rent, that is. The laws, the rules favor those. But what laws and rules favor homeless people, poor people? And yet we do this as if I'm just doing my job. I thought we learned something from the Nuremberg trials, that no longer can someone say, I'm doing my job following orders, if it is found that those orders are counterproductive to human life and actually put people at risk. So we have people freezing. So where are these 30 million homeless people? 2.5 million school children are homeless. They're couch surfing. They're living with in-laws and friends. They're living in cars and vans. They're living by the tens of thousands in southern states where it's warmer in the woods. And every so often, a local mayor, and you'll see me confronting that local mayor in Titusville, will come in with the bulldozers and the authorities and the police, and they'll bulldoze down everything. And now those veterans, once again, they had nothing to begin with. They did have some order. If you've ever been to any of their camps, you'll see that they used their survival skills that they learned in the Marines, the Army, A, to protect each other, B, to protect the women soldiers who sleep in the middle of the camps and are protected. But when they're out on the street, to a person, they've been raped and beaten. When did we ever hear about the rape and beating of homeless female vets? Have you seen any articles in any papers? Is it on anyone's agenda? Were you even aware there's a million homeless vets? No. But I've been there. I've seen them. I've interviewed them. I filmed them. I did a multi-award-winning documentary called Homeless Vets, or American Veterans Discarded and Forgotten. They're there. But all these problems are out of people's sight. Down in New Orleans, I recently filmed people waiting outside in the middle of the cold around a block. And just standing there, sitting on the street, and to get into one shelter. So I went in the shelter, and I was shown around, and I filmed. And the guy said, look, you know, we just don't have enough room. If we allowed everyone in, we run out of food. But we try. We give them some clothes if we have it. Under worst-case scenario, if it gets really cold, even if we squeeze them in here and just have them stand or sit, because there's no beds, those are filled. At least they're not in the cold. But the trouble is they are in the cold, because I was there and saw below 40 degrees how many people are still outside. Now, they don't have the money to buy down coats and sleeping bags. I found one 28-year-old American vet in a T-shirt in the winter, curled up under a tree. He wasn't drunk. He wasn't on drugs. He was just poor. So here's my question. Since when should we rely upon the churches, like Father Dowd over at Sacred Heart Church in Camden, and all the other places and the good work and the decent work and the spiritual work of people who still remember something called ethics, morality, when our government can squander trillions of dollars a year on nothing that helps anyone except themselves and their cronies, and we say nothing. We do nothing. We allow this. As long as a good Democrat sticking it up, then we say it's okay. It's not okay. And it's time that true liberals took back the Liberal Party from the corrupt forces that have controlled everything from the Nation magazine to NPR to PBS and even Pacifica. It's time people stood up and took it back. Finally tonight, or today, I want to play you a bit of a piece before time runs out of a person who watched the loved one get killed and the response to it. This is not what you normally hear in the media when it comes to justifying cops killing a person. Listen up.
Cops in Moore, Oklahoma beat a man to death even though he did absolutely nothing wrong. Now, a family of three were walking out of a movie theater. Now, it was a husband, wife, and their 19-year-old daughter. The wife and the daughter got into some sort of argument, and the argument ended with the wife slapping her across her face. Then she felt very upset about it and started walking toward the car. As she was doing that, her husband, Luis Rodriguez, was following her to the car. Now, at that point, police arrived to the scene because they were already there for some unrelated incident, and they started asking him questions. The way that it ended is apparently they had asked him for ID. That's what the police is alleging. And Luis Rodriguez told them, hey, mind your own business. This is a family issue. It's a family matter. He refused to give them ID, and then they proceeded to beat him and spray his face with pepper spray. Now, we have a video that we're about to show you that's very, very difficult to watch. It is graphic, but it's the video that his wife was taking as the police were beating him up, and you can hear her screaming and asking if he's still alive. Take a quick look.
Luis, please. Luis, please.
Calm down, sir.
Luis, are you okay?
He's fine.
Is he bleeding?
I'm bleeding. All right, that's me. But I've got medical here. They're going to come check him out, make sure he's okay.
Papa!
Here, I need you to get this. I'm not going to go through your stuff. Get your ID out for me, okay? What I want you to do, I want you to move right here. I want you to have a seat right on this pole, okay?
I'm recording because
that's fine. You can record from over here, okay?
Papa! Is he okay? He doesn't move!
They've got him. They're going to take care of him.
He doesn't move! You kill him! You kill him!
He's getting medical attention right now. I just need to stay over here.
You're killing my husband!
He was completely unarmed. No knife, no weapon, no gun. He stopped breathing when they put him onto the emergency truck, and they got him to the hospital. He was in stable condition momentarily, and then he stopped breathing again. He died as a result of this, and the daughter did talk to the press. She said five guys got on top of him, beating him ruthlessly on the head, just pow, 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 even with knees. When they flipped him over, you could see all the blood on his face. He was disfigured. You couldn't recognize him.
Man, they always go to, like, nuclear reaction. Not always, I know, but so many stories where, okay, there's five of you. The guy didn't give you ID. You don't even, like, you were called in because of a dispute between the mom and the daughter, but you immediately go to the guy. You don't know that he did anything wrong. In fact, the only information you have is that it doesn't involve him at all, right? If you have any information, it's not about him. But you've got, okay, well, because the biggest crime in America is, in their minds, disrespecting the police. Like, not the whatever you were called onto the scene for, not a crime that the guy committed, but you didn't listen to me for a second, or you said, hey, I'm in the middle of a family affair, this doesn't, how dare you? Five of us, let's pummel you to death, which is literally what they did here.
I mean, and they're like, he didn't give ID, so what? Mm-hmm. Like, so what? Literally, so what? Like, you have all the time in the world. you can arrest him if you want. You know, at some point, you just say to him, put your arms behind your back, and you put cuffs on him, and you go through his wallet. I mean, like, you know, which is probably, that's even unnecessary. But everybody could go home after that event.
So
you know?
They did release a police report, and I read it. And the police are alleging that they did attempt to arrest him after he refused to show them ID, and that he, quote, took a fighting stance. And that was when the cops went after him. And I watched that video over and over again to kind of analyze it and pick up on little hints and clues. And if you notice, there's a point where he's just on the floor. He's not moving at all. And you hear one of the cops say, calm down, sir, because you can. He knows that the wife is taking footage of it, right? He's calmed down. He's not even moving. They're trying to make a point that, no, this guy is dangerous. And then you also hear him say, another cop say, no, I'm the one bleeding.
Yeah, where's, you look at all the blood. No, I'm bleeding. No, he's bleeding from the head and he's going to die.
You know, these cases of excessive force, in the rearview mirror, they always look, they just look so hideous, you know? And the thing is, the public pays and trains and entrusts these people to be professionals. They know more about the use of force than I do. But I do know that we all have a fight or flight mechanism. And when five dudes are on top of you with their knees, their arms, their, you can't breathe, you go into a fight or flight behavior, which is, I'm dying here. I can't breathe. I'm on my back. They've got their knees on me, my head. It's like we've seen this over and over and over again. And it's not so much it's not so much disrespecting them. It's trying to breathe. It's trying to survive some crazy thing that just happened to you. One moment you're walking out of a mall. Next thing you know, five people, men, are leaning on your lungs while you're laying on the parking lot. And that, to me, is like that the poorly trained cop. That's the point. And that's why it's like we want them to know better.
If you know it, how can they not know it? How does
That's exactly the point I thought after this story, because I have always assumed, obviously incredibly naively, that they got good training and that whenever they did these excessive force stories we cover, that those guys were knuckleheads and they were whatever it might be. They didn't listen while they were getting trained. They were roid raging. I don't know what it is, right? But I'm now beginning to wonder what the hell training they get.
Yeah.
Because this is so systemic and it happens again and again and again. And you would think that they would train people to say, hey, listen, when you got five guys on top of a guy, his natural reaction is going to want to get up, right? Because he can't breathe. So don't flip out and keep pounding him in the head, because some people, you know, could take a lot of that. Some people die after you pound them in the head or cut off their lungs for a short period of time.
That's right.
So we don't want people dying on us, especially if we don't know what they did. So here's your proper training. And I'm now beginning to believe that we're not doing that effectively across the country.
In the aftermath of all of this, three of the cops have been placed on, they've been suspended with pay. There is an investigation, and the investigation was taken over by the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, so they're looking into it. However, the head of the police force there is basically sticking up for them and saying, hey.
As we continue, the question is, should the police be considered more valuable as a life force than anyone else in our society, any other human being? Because what we're not seeing in the major media, we're not seeing in Congress, we're not seeing at the state level, are honest, insightful discussions about how we should look at all these taserings, arrests, homicides by the police that get no attention whatsoever. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Yatrice Lead. Hi, Yatrice.
Hello, Gary. Today, Paris, France, and Baga, Nigeria. White lives, black lives, and terrorism. And we go to Detroit, where there's a fighting spirit, even though there are fewer fighters.
Right now, Yatrice Lead.